Okay. So, what I want to talk about today is something that will be appearing on the exam, and this has to do with the relationship between natural law and human rights, and in particular in the period that we are now, where the status of the human is so much up for grabs. And yesterday, I sent you some a set of articles that, in a way, capture the full range of issues we're talking about here. And so, you know, when you know, if you see a question of this kind having to do with the relationship between natural law and human rights, you should assume that it has a very sort of broad scope to it, this question. I mean, next week at this time, I will be reviewing the exam questions that are likely to come up in this part of the course. But, I mean, the point here is that there will be a lot of issues we'll be talking about in a brief period of time. And, in a sense, you can pick and choose which ones that you find most relevant for your concerns. Now, the first point, let's start on a historical note. And as I said last term, the idea of natural law is an idea that, while it has roots in Stoic philosophy in the Greek and Roman world, in fact really comes into its own as a legal doctrine with Christianity, and indeed the way to interpret what natural law is in that context is basically the laws governing nature is laid down by God. Okay. And that is to say, the laws governing nature normally. So so the presupposition of the idea of natural law was that there was a sense in which God had a sort of plan or design, right? That the world isn't just arbitrary, and in a sense, natural law is responsive to that. And so there are two elements to natural law, and these two elements, in a way, became more and more distinguished as the centuries went on. One aspect of natural law is, you might say, the descriptive aspect, the aspect that still remains when we talk about natural laws in the sense of physics having natural laws, physics being about laws of nature in that sense. And so that is to say, the empirical regularities of nature understood as something that applies everywhere for all times. But of course, there's this other sense of law, which is the sense that we're most familiar with in talking about the legal system and jurisprudence and things of that kind, which is law in a normative sense, and that is to say the way things ought to be. It isn't just a matter that the world is got these certain regularities in which the planets revolve around the sun and so forth, but rather that is the way it ought to be. And there's reason for this, and you know, this is God's reason. And natural law has that as well. And I think the important thing to remember is that in the beginning, these two ideas were very much entangled with each other. They were very much seen as part of the same thing. And one place where that integration of the descriptive and the normative has remained for a very long time is when we talk about human nature, right? Natural law in the context of human nature. What sorts of things are permissible by virtue of being going with the grain of human nature? What sorts of things are prohibited by virtue of going against the grain of human nature? Now, when we talk about human nature in that sense, so for example, when we have laws against pedophilia, okay? Laws against pedophilia, why? Why exactly? Well, I mean, the arguments that are still used in the legal system, even in a legal system that is secular, and you know, doesn't really rely very heavily on natural law on a regular basis, is that it goes against human nature, right? There's a sense in which there's just something bad. You're sort of a perverted, corrupt human being, right, if you make sexual advances to children. Okay? Now, that conception of human nature, which is still operative in quite a lot of our laws, typically have to do when we're talking about human beings. And we're talking about not merely how they are, but how they ought to be. And I think the way you can think about how this is merged is with the idea of, you might say, proper functioning. When a human being is properly functioning, when a human being is sane, when a human being is in full control of his senses, right? When we use those kinds, when a human being is being reasonable, right? When we say all those things, right? What we're doing is we're blurring the descriptive and the normative, because we're not just talking normatively in the sense of an impossible ideal that no one can reach. No, we're actually making reference to what we believe that people are doing most of the time. Right? Or at least, want to do most of the time. So that's how the blurring occurs. And so this idea of natural law, where it kind of retains this kind of original sense that it had from Christianity of blurring the descriptive and the normative aspects of our being, is pretty much when we're talking about laws governing human nature, human beings, and human rights. Right? So pedophilia is a violation of human rights. The rights of children. Okay, so that kind of idea of natural law is still very strongly there. So even though we talk about, when you do the history of jurisprudence, right, the normal way of doing the history is to say, well, once we start to get into the 19th and 20th centuries and we start to have much more developed civil law systems based on the nation state, the idea of there being a sort of overarching natural law doesn't really matter so much anymore, because you basically have sovereign legislatures which, through their constitutions, become the guarantors of the law. And this is where you get the kind of the dominance of positive law over natural law. And you're all familiar with that, I assume. But nevertheless, even in that context, when we're talking about the integrity of human beings, we still go back to a natural law concept. Okay. Now, I'm saying all this because when we start to move into the late 20th century and the period that we're living in now, we start to get a kind of blurring of the intuition about what it is to be human. Okay? Now, natural law historically has really had a lot of purchase, especially in the discussion of human beings, when we have thought that the idea of human nature implied something permanent, essential, about what it is to be a human being, without which you could not be human. Now, in the period that we currently live in, this is being challenged. And it's being challenged from two directions. The first direction, which I mentioned in the last time we met in one of the lectures, was that, in fact, the kinds of rights that we have traditionally extended to human beings under the rubric of human rights is being increasingly extended to animals. Okay. Especially when it comes to issues relating to harm, and even responsibilities for protection, custody. Right, so in a sense, I think it's fair to say that that gradually legal opinion is migrating to a position where certainly the higher order animals are becoming increasingly treated like, you might say, permanent children in terms of their legal coverage. I mean, whereas childhood is regarded as a transition phase that has laws that govern people within a certain age group, right? If one imagines that one is in that state forever, you start to get close to what a lot of the animal rights activists and so forth are arguing now. Okay, and so then the question becomes, what is distinct? Is there something distinctive about human rights that one would want legal protection over once we have started to expand this notion of animal rights, so that it has a lot of the characteristics that traditionally only human rights had? Okay, so there's that issue. But then the other issue has to do with the degree to which human beings have become increasingly integrated with non-human things. Okay, so for example, you may know, with stem cell research, for example, And that's not the only area. We're getting a greater and greater incidence of what's called xenotransplantation. Okay. And xenotransplantation is basically when you take genetic material or some other organic substance from one species and you put it in another species, right? So xeno is the Greek word for stranger, alien, right?
And so, of course, if you want to regenerate someone's liver, you might put the liver of another animal in the human being, right? Or a heart, maybe. There have been experiments with pigs' hearts, in human beings, right? That kind of thing happens, and it's likely to increasingly happen, especially as we are able to manipulate the genes of animals, at a more fine-grained level. And then be able to, as it were, farm these animals for human use. So not only would we be farming animals to eat them, but we would be farming animals to directly constitute us, to become part of us, literally. And so one could imagine, I guess in principle, a situation where an enormous percentage of a person who was born as a human being turns out to have parts from other animals. Enormous percentage of their body consists of parts from other animals or other non-human sources. Not just other animals, of course, but, silicon, right? Pacemakers for hearts, computer chips in your brain. This is already happening. Okay? Now, what happens when you get to a point where a person who was born a human being has had a sufficient number of operations and substitutions done to their body that actually the amount of the body that is, from a biological standpoint, human, turns out to be, what, 60% maybe? Is there a problem? Okay. Is there a problem, in terms of the legal status of that person? Is it sufficient that the person was born a human being? Okay. And now, what if you have it the other way around? So supposing we get, because this is also potentially going to happen as we get more sophisticated technologies and so forth, that we might put parts of human beings into non-humans. Animals, for example. We want to save the life of a dog. We might want to put a human organ into the dog. Okay, especially if the human being is otherwise dead. Right? We have these donor cards, right, when you die, where they can farm your organs to... we usually think about this in the context of human beings being the recipients of these things, but why can't Fido be the recipient? Okay? And what if we have stem cell research where we're farming all these human stem cells and we can put them into animals to help them regenerate? Now, what happens to the status of those creatures? Xenotransplantation the other way around. Does their status rise, legally speaking? Because now they've got a lot of human bits in them, a lot of important human bits in them. Okay? Now this is the kind of thing legal system will have to sort of struggle with in the coming century, okay? Because from a traditional legal standpoint, one of the things that we say, for example, is that there is a kind of integrity and sanctity to life, and that there's a very clear sense of where life begins and ends, and there's a clear sense of whose life is it and what is the nature of that life. But once we start blurring categories like this, then questions get opened up pretty substantially. So, for example, if you were to ask a lawyer in the beginning of the 20th century, can you patent life? The lawyer would laugh in your face, right? Because life is precisely the kind of thing you cannot patent, right? You can only patent artificial manufacturing processes. So, you can patent inventions, you can patent things that make products, you can patent those kinds of things. They have to be the products of artifice. And the understanding was that there was a very clear line to draw between nature and artifice, right? Between what happens naturally without our interference and what happens only because of our interference. Now, all of this got completely turned upside down when we discovered that DNA was the basis of genetics, on the basis of which organisms are generated, back in 1953. And then we suddenly, as it were, cracked the genetic code. Now, cracking the genetic code basically gave us a procedure by which one could assemble organisms. And of course, in principle, right, so 1953, we couldn't do that yet. But of course, what has happened in the history of molecular genetics in the 50 years after the discovery of DNA has basically made this
pretty clear that you can do this. We can now sequence human genomes. We can manufacture them. I mean, one of the guys who sequenced the human genome, Craig Venter, right? In fact, has this company, you know, Celera, which in fact does this for profit.
And so you can patent bits of genetic code, so you can reproduce it. You can manufacture it. You can insert it in various biomedical procedures. Okay? So, a lot of aspects of life are now covered under patent law. And indeed, one of the things that some lawyers have argued is that the way to counteract this trend would be for individuals, when they're born, to seek copyright on their genetic makeup. Now, you see, look at the kind of discussion that we're getting into here, right? We have basically brought the discussion of life from the realms of natural law, where we're talking about, you know, absolute notions of human dignity and things like that, into the realm of intellectual property. And it doesn't just stop there, okay? As you know, there is this issue of... One of the articles I have given you is on biodiplomacy. And one of the issues that arises from there is the business of indigenous peoples, that is to say, people who we, you know, in the past would have been called primitive, people who live in so-called native cultures that are self-governing and largely outside of traditional nation-state structures, at least for a lot of their day-to-day life. These people tend to be inbred. And so they have very distinctive kind of genetic code to them, and that this genetic code that they have, you know, has some very distinctive effects. In other words, they may be particularly susceptible to certain diseases, but at the same time, they may be relatively immune to other diseases. So from a biomedical standpoint, these people tend to be quite interesting, and the thought is that if you can kind of mine their genome, which is to say to figure out what it is in their genetic makeup that actually enables them, let's say, to be susceptible to diseases that other people get, that you could then synthesize that and use it for biomedical treatments. Okay. So what's happened here is that now you have this enormous amount of intellectual property law that has kind of developed around this, and the attitude that the indigenous people have, right, is at first it was to say, we want nothing to do with this. We do not think of our genetic makeup as biocapital or something like that. No, you know, we treat it as kind of some kind of sacred thing based on our cosmology, blah, blah, blah. But now the opinion has changed, right? And increasingly, these people are willing to do business. Okay? And so they want special kinds of internationally binding intellectual property law that will enable the fair transactions to take place over the genetic makeup of indigenous peoples. So they can get a good deal, essentially. Okay?
Now, you know, you can imagine, I mean, you know, you think about, imagine you were Karl Marx listening to all this. Right? You'd be turning over in your grave. Right? Because in a sense, this is the extent to which capitalism has really kind of gotten into the heartland of what it is for us to be who we are. I don't make this point frivolously, because capitalism is a very interesting kind of development in terms of these issues we're talking about. And Max Weber was particularly alert to this. And what I have in mind is the following.
As you know, Max Weber talks about the close connection between the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. And I have an article that I've asked you to look at by Hans Joas, who's a contemporary German social theorist, which is about Weber's views on human rights. And the interesting thing is the way in which the idea of human rights first arose in capitalist culture in the modern era, how capitalism and human rights went together initially. Right, and this had a lot to do with the Protestant roots of capitalism. Because one of the things that capitalism tended to do, okay, was to actually get rid of rather traditional pre-capitalist ideas of property.
And what that meant was that not only did it enable the land to be used for something other than farming, right? We think about the Industrial Revolution. If you've studied British history, you know about the Enclosure Acts, things of that kind, right? Where you can basically take the farmland and turn it into factories, right?
It's not just that. That's not the only sense in which the idea of property changed under capitalism, but also the idea of human beings not being property
is also one of the revolutions of capitalism, okay? Because so
capitalism allowed people to sell their own labor. Now, you know, Marx, of course, points to this
and says this ends up leading people to be able to dehumanize themselves, okay? Because market forces drives down the price of labor. But in the beginning, the idea of being able to sell your own labor, that you own your own self, okay, was seen as a very progressive move.
Because what was the alternative? Right? You have to think of what was the alternative. The alternative was you were born into a certain status in which you could never change by virtue of your birth. So you're born a slave or a serf or whatever, right? And all of your legal rights and obligations were governed by that hereditary category. Okay? Whereas what capitalism allowed was for individuals, as it were, as individuals to be covered legally, and they could do what they will with themselves.
So they can sell themselves however they wish.
Now, Weber points out that this whole idea of the human being as a sort of free agent in the marketplace is based historically on a very strong Protestant individualist idea of the autonomy of the individual. Right, as the seat of the soul, as a person who is the master of their fate. Okay, and in the article by Hans Joas, you will see that Weber was very much influenced by a German legal theorist of the preceding generation, right, from the mid-19th century, a guy named Jelinek, okay, he's usually part of what's called the historical jurisprudence in a German tradition. And Jelinek wrote a book on the Declaration of the Rights of Man, where he basically tries to talk about the modern origin of this doctrine of human rights and draws a lot of attention to the continuity between Protestantism and its radical focus on the individual and what you see with modern human rights ideas and with capitalism. So Jelinek focuses specifically on the American Revolution. Okay, because as you know, the phrase the Declaration of the Rights of Man comes from the French Revolution. And the point that Jelinek makes, which influences Weber, is that in fact the French Revolution it doesn't really give you a good clue to understand where the idea of human rights comes from, at least in terms of its theological roots, because the French Revolution made such a big deal about distinguishing God from humans in a very strong way, that in a sense the way in which human rights could be asserted in the French Revolution was with breaking away from the church, breaking away from any kind of religious authority.
Whereas in the American Revolution, God is not denied, if you look at the founding documents with regard to the American Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, and of course you know in the United States, the money still carries the slogan, "In God We Trust." Okay, I mean, so God is all over the place. But God is taken into the hands of individuals. There is no established church. Right? So what happens is, God, you might say, gets devolved
in the American context. It's not that God is eliminated, but God is devolved. So God is no longer this kind of being that hangs over us in some way, but rather we are, as it were, instances of God in the way we operate in the world, and that becomes the basis for our dignity. And this is the sort of thing that Thomas Jefferson called inalienable rights.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, this kind of thing,
which comes from John Locke, the English theorist, so a political theorist of the early 18th century. And this is the kind of thing that Jefferson is talking about. And in the article by Joas, you'll see that there is this discussion of the theological backstory to this, that basically people like Jefferson believed that we had God in us. We were created in the image and likeness of God, and God was literally in us, and it's on that basis that we have these rights, and these rights prevent us from selling ourselves literally as slaves. And this ends up having all kinds of knock-on effects for other things like marriages. Okay? Because in the early days, when people wanted to change the law of marriages so that women couldn't just be forced to marry other people, in the West, this kind of idea came into play, that women had this too, just like men did. And that women could not be treated as property, except that the women owned themselves. That's the only sense in which they were property. They owned themselves, and they cannot sell themselves. See, remember, the word alienation, I mean, I'm sure someone has told you this before, but the word alienation is an old Latin word for when you sell property, right? So when you take a piece of your land and you sell it to someone else, you're alienating it. Okay? And so all of this stuff about inalienable rights has to do with the stuff you cannot sell. Okay? That's how you define your essence of human being is that you cannot sell this part of yourself. There's a part of yourself that cannot be property. Okay? And this was very integral to capitalism, Protestantism, and the rise of human rights. Now, this gets very complicated when we talk about something like indigenous. You know, we talk about sort of this specific kind of indigenous genetic makeup of native peoples and stuff like this. This problem in the 21st century becomes increasingly problematic because when we're talking about genetics, we're talking about properties of people that they have in aggregate. We're talking about populations. Right, so you know, if we talk about an indigenous people, like we talk about, you know, the inhabitants of Papua New Guinea, okay, and we're saying these people have a kind of a common genetic code, right? We're talking about something that they own collectively, and the question is, okay, what is the status of that? Because when we were talking about the inalienable rights of human beings that Thomas Jefferson was on about, these were rights that pertained to the individuals as having been created individually in the image and likeness of God. But when we talk about the rights that indigenous people have to their genetic makeup, we're talking to rights that they have by virtue of being part of this gene pool. It's a collective right. And then the question becomes, what is the nature, what's the difference between that kind of right and this older sense of right? And this, by the way, is not just going to apply to indigenous peoples. It's going to apply to any kind of understanding of the human being in genetic terms. Because what genetics is all about at the end of the day is about populations. And that is to say, the overlap between the specific genomes of a group of people who are able to interbreed and produce fruitful offspring. That is a kind of operational definition of what a species is. Okay? Now, to be a human is to be able to participate in that kind of population genetically. You are able to breed with someone and produce fertile offspring. So it's not a property that you have individually. It is a property by virtue of the way you can interact with others in a certain way, having to do with sexual reproduction. That is what the biological definition of a human being is. Okay. And insofar as all of our notions of what it is to have a particular kind of identity, so we're talking about indigenous people or people in general, insofar as we rely on contemporary biological criteria from genetics, right, there is always going to be some ambiguity there, right? Because we're basically talking about an interactive property, a property you have by virtue of your ability to breed with others. That's what it boils down to. That's what makes you a human being, from a strictly biological standpoint. Okay. Now, this then raises the issue, well, what exactly follows from this? So if that's the way you define a human being, right, so we're not defining a human, you see, If you go back to Thomas Jefferson's time and you ask him, well, why do human beings have these inalienable rights? He won't just tell you it's because we somehow descended from God, but rather the kinds of qualities that make us godlike. We have reason, we have free will, right? These are the kinds of things that supposedly God provided us that makes us such special beings that entitle us to inalienable rights. That's the story that you find throughout the history of Christianity, and you even find it in secular thinkers like Thomas Jefferson, who were descendants of that Christian framework, and it's still there in the American Constitution. Okay? And of course, in many legal cases, when we talk about the integrity and dignity of the human being, we're often talking about those things too, about people having free will, about people having reason, and all the rest of it. But increasingly, as we get into these kind of border cases, these difficult border cases, where it's not clear, you know, where exactly the human and non-human is to be divided, right, where it's no longer straightforward, then we fall back more on these biological categories, but then that kind of blurs the issue a bit. So exactly what are we protecting if we're protecting the sanctity of a certain species? What are we protecting exactly, and why are we protecting it the way we do? Okay, and the legal system is really playing catch up with all this because there are a lot of demands being made. So, for example, you know, I've read an article where someone has actually made the case that there should be Android rights, where Android rights basically cover any kind of human-like silicon-based thing, so computers, you know, robots, things of that kind. That there should be something like rights there because there's a significant percentage of the human population whose meaningful interactions from a social standpoint are primarily with those things. Okay? And so, in that respect, the interactions that we, you know, as humans have with these things justify the protection of those things. Okay? Now, how are you supposed to think about this? Well, you might think about this in terms of why we protect animals, certain kinds of animals that we can relate to in some way. But also, I think there's precedent also in terms of the reason why we have things like heritage sites. And we protect certain kinds of artifacts as having special, meaningful significance, legal standing, so that they cannot be violated. Okay? So there are lots of legal precedents one can draw on here, but the overall effect is again to sort of attenuate the idea that there is something distinctive about human rights that doesn't blur into something else. Okay. Now, where this issue becomes really problematic from a political standpoint is where there are resource constraints. Because look, in a perfect world, we could be protecting everything. We could be protecting all human beings, all animals, all things. We could just protect, right? We could have rights, obligations governing all these things. But the resources are just not there to do that, okay? And so then what happens is you start to get into this mode of what we normally call ecological thinking. And I think it's very important to understand this idea of what ecological thinking means in this context. I mean, ecological comes from the Greek oikos, which means home, right? And so the idea that you're being asked to consider is that there is this kind of self-sustaining world, and then the question is, who can belong to it, right? So when you hear very extreme versions of the ecological movement, you may know about Gaia, the Gaia hypothesis, right? You know, in other words, the Earth is a finite organism, right? If it's going to function properly, we can only have so many human beings in it, we can only have so many animals in it, right? Otherwise it will not be able to function properly in an integral fashion. So then the question becomes, what is the optimal number of people and things, and how should they interact with each other in order to sustain an ecology? And this then starts to govern issues about who should live and who should die, and what should we do about what kind of movements should people have, and whether people should be high carbon emitters or not, and all these kinds of questions come into play, right? I mean, you know, the question about whether we should be carbon neutral is kind of, you know, at the soft end of this problem. You know, at the hard end of the problem is whether people should be allowed to reproduce in areas of overpopulation. Okay, and so then the issue of what human rights are in this context is up for grabs, because human rights are no longer seen in isolation. They are no longer seen as having some kind of absolute status, but are rather seen as part of a kind of network of ecological rights and obligations. Okay? I mean, because, you know, in the way in which we've traditionally thought about the legal system, there's a sense in which the integrity and the dignity of the human being is, you know, kind of like the final court of appeal. You do not violate that. But what if we shift the ground and we say, actually, the absolute court of appeal is not the human being, but it's the ecosystem, and we shall not violate that. Because if we violate that, then everything goes. This may mean the curtailment or the redefinition of human rights. Now, one context where this arises has to do with thoughts about future generations. And again, there is quite a lot of literature in economics, in law, in politics about future generations. I have an article I've sent to you that is on this. Attorneys for the future. Attorneys for the future. Right? And so the idea being, right, that if we are thinking, especially in terms of ecological horizons, and we're talking, you know, the long term, the environment, and so forth, then we've got to be concerned not only with what's in the best interests and what does the justice to the people who are on the ground now, but the future. Right? And of course, a lot of ecological discourse is like that, right? Namely, if we do not conserve energy now, if we do not go carbon neutral now, then there will be nothing for our children or grandchildren to deal with. Now the question becomes, what is the legal standing of arguments of this kind? And they're increasingly being tried out in courts around the world. Okay. And what I want to do here is to distinguish two ways of thinking about this matter. And the first way, which is the irreversible versus the reversible. Now, here's the irreversible argument about future generations, you might say, is the more cynical argument. In other words, it's the argument that, in a sense, wants to kind of not give too much credence to this issue. Because basically, it's going to say, okay, because, you know, sometimes you get this argument, we need to conserve energy, we need to conserve resources, because otherwise people in the future will not have it as good as we have had it. Right? We will have spent all the money, we will have, you know, polluted all the air and the water, and so our children and grandchildren will be leading impoverished lives, and that is irresponsible. Well, one way to go against that idea is to say, well, look, we don't know what the future is going to be like, even with the best intentions. And in any case, people who live in the time they live always think that this is, that it's reasonably good. Okay? In other words, there is what's called adaptive preference formation. Adaptive preference formation. In other words, people come to value the things that, to a large extent, they are already exposed to or is within reasonable grasp of their expectations. Now, what does this mean in practice as a sort of a long-term issue? It means that people's values will change as their environment changes. And I think a good way to see this is by looking at what people were saying about the introduction of the automobile in the early 20th century, about what a disaster the introduction of the automobile would be.
because it would pollute the air, pollute the water, you know, use up all this petroleum, right? It would be noisy. It would destroy all the landscape because roads would be all over the place. It would lead to accidents. People would die. Of course, all that's true. Right? Those guys weren't wrong in what they said. All of that did happen, even probably more than they imagined. But of course, one of the things that happened also was that people's values changed. So they say, hey, I want to get somewhere fast. Hey, I like the freedom of being able to just get in my car and go everywhere the hell I feel like it, you know? And hell, who needs clean air anyway, you know? All I need is, you know, I can just breathe into this oxygen tank every now and then. Right? So this is what I mean. People's values change, right? In light of all of these new... So if we're looking at what people think about the automobile 100 years after it's introduced... You don't say, well, those guys, they got it wrong. We really didn't pollute the air. We really didn't pollute the water. We really didn't use all those resources. We really didn't have all those accidents. Oh, yes, we did, but it doesn't matter so much. Because our values have changed. We value other things more. So we're able to live with this stuff. We're able to absorb the cost. It's not that the costs were not anticipated. They were, but rather we have changed our values, so we are happy to absorb the costs. Okay? That's adaptive preference formation. Your preferences adapt to your situation. Now, of course, you living now, you living in the late 20th, early 21st century, you don't think about it this way because you don't know what it was like in the early 20th century. You don't know what you weren't around back in 1900. So you don't know any of this. Oh, you don't know, as it were, what the old world was. Right? You just know the world you're in, and you're doing perfectly fine there. Because the whole world's kind of changed, reoriented itself, and you're doing fine in that world. Okay? And this kind of thing, of course, happens throughout history. It's not that people get the future wrong, right, when they come up with all these horrendous, you know, predictions. Of course they get it wrong sometimes, but not always. It's rather people's values change so that what seemed to be horrendous 100 years ago does not seem horrendous to the people who actually have to live with the consequences. And so the point about the irreversibility thing is they will say, look, when you eco-mongers start to say that our children will not have all the kind of advantages that we had, will not be able to have access to the clean air, will not be able to move the way they do. Well, it's not that you're wrong and you're, you know, I mean, you may be right, but by the time that happens, people will want to do different things. They will value different things. You know, so for example, if people end up spending as much time in front of their computers as they are now, and they continue to do so in the future, and more of life gets transpired through the computer, man, you can just kill the environment. As long as you can stay in your house with the artificial air pumped in, right? People's values change.
Okay, now you say, well, there's limits to this. You can't go overboard with this. And that may be true too. But the point is, one shouldn't automatically assume that the sorts of changes that we make now would somehow have future generations cursing us.
Because by the time it happens, their values will have changed. And insofar as we give those people the right to determine their own lives, right, just as we feel we have the right to determine our lives, we shouldn't prejudge what they would think. Okay?
I mean, because one of the interesting things about history, of course, is if you look at people's historical judgments, you have a lot of people always kind of doom-mongering about the future. But very, you know, you don't have so many people saying, my God, those guys back then 100 years ago, we shouldn't have had that industrial revolution. We shouldn't have had those cars. We would have been a lot better off today. You do have a few people saying that, but it's interesting you don't have a lot of people saying stuff like that. Okay, because basically people live with the circumstances they're in. So this then creates an issue about what exactly counts as intergenerational justice, right? What exactly is it, you know, what is the nature of the responsibility we have to these people in the future, right? And so from the irreversible standpoint, namely you say, well look, yes, the world changes. Yes, the environment will change. We will have changed it. Yes, The people in the future will have a different set of options from us. They might not be a set of options that we particularly would want, but hell, by the time it gets to that time, people will have changed what they think is valuable. They'll deal with it. Trust them. Right? That's one attitude, which would be a very kind of, you might say, kind of neoliberal sort of attitude. You know? Just let it happen. Now, of course, the way in which this is normally thought about, and this is what the article brings up, is the idea that, in a sense, intergenerational justice should be about enabling people in the future, in some sense, to be able to reverse whatever decisions that we take now. This is the reversibility argument, right? In other words, people in the future should have the same sphere of freedom that we have now, in the sense that we make certain decisions to do certain things, but they should not preclude people in the future from doing something different. So in other words, if we are going to pollute the atmosphere, we should not do it so much that it becomes impossible for people in the future to be able to be at the state that we are now. Okay, so that this is an argument for constraint, right? Imagining that people in the future would want the same range of options that we have now. And this is the usual way in which intergenerational justice is discussed. Now, the problem with this, and this is the issue the economists bring up, is how exactly are you to measure this, right? Issues of justice always revolve around proportionality, right? So in other words, what does it mean to say that we are only going to, you know, we're only going to use up natural resources to a certain extent, so that people in the future will have the same amount to deal with themselves? How do you actually figure that out? Okay? That's not easy, but obviously if we're going to talk about justice in that sense of having proportionality, we need to figure this out. And so, as you'll see in that article on attorneys for the future, people do this kind of cost-benefit analysis stuff. And what it boils down to, basically, is that you basically take all of the resources, all of the things that people in the present are using that can have impact on future decisions, and you give it a monetary value. You give everything a monetary value. Okay? Then you basically want, you add it all up, you look at the cost of doing various things, and you basically want to leave the future with the same total sum. Okay, so in other words, if you're going to be polluting the air in a certain way, then you have to compensate for that in some other fashion, in some appropriate fashion. You know, a lot of this stuff with that sort of trading of carbon shares, you may have run across that. That's kind of in the spirit of this, where you're trying to get some kind of overall ecological package that remains constant, so that if you're spending resources in one place, right, you're reallocating it somewhere else, you're saving it somewhere else. And this is understood in terms of money, in terms of costs and benefits, and so forth. Now, the authors of this article that I've given you are relatively skeptical about whether this idea can really work in practice. But in a sense, that has been kind of the founding notion of intergenerational justice. Namely, you leave the future with the same potential for action in the world as you have had for yourself. That's the basic principle involved. And then the question becomes, how do you establish the relevant sense of proportionality that would enable this to work? Okay, so the question of how you measure justice across generations. Okay. So that's where we are now. And so there's a lot of very interesting kinds of issues here that arise from the fact that natural law has now really moved far away from its theological basis to this very kind of this basis is very strongly influenced by new developments in science, especially biotechnology. And so the issue of what it is to be a human being, what it is to preserve the legal sanctity of the human being, all of these issues are up for renegotiation, and especially in the context of thinking about humans, not only in our own society, in our own time, but thinking about future generations as well. Okay, and so the reason why I have given you this lecture is not just because of the exam, but also because I think this is a very exciting area. There's a lot of very interesting thinking to be done from a legal standpoint
about the nature of the human, given all of these issues, the blurring of the human-non-human boundary, and the whole,
you know, kind of increasing imperative to think in ecological, transgenerational terms about justice. Okay? So I'll leave you with that. And then next week at this time in this place, we will formally go through the topics that will come up in the exam. Okay?